Welcome to the Proper Mental Podcast. Normalizing open and honest conversations about mental health by having open and honest conversations about mental health. Welcome to another episode of the Proper Mental Podcast. And before we get into it, I want to tell you about something. I've got some awesome news. I've just announced a live show on the 17th of May. I haven't done one for a couple of years. So I'm very excited about it. It's going to be at the Bloom Building in Birkenhead, which is home to the Open Door charity. And we've got a couple of guests lined up. And after that, there's going to be a little bit of live music. And then we're staying open. It's on a Friday night and we're staying open a little bit later. Last time we did it, it was such a wonderful thing. And at the end, people just wanted to sort of hang out and chat amongst themselves and chat to new people. And it was a real community feel to it. But it was on a Tuesday and people had to get off. So this time we've purposely moved it to a Friday. We're staying open a bit later. And so there'll be a chance just to hang out. If you're coming on your own, well, there'll be plenty of people to chat to if you so wish. And it's just going to be really lovely. All the money from the ticket sales is going to charities that are chosen by the guest. And all the money taken on the bar at the evening will be going to the Open Door to help them provide free mental health support to young people in the local area. So that's the 17th of May. Tickets are on sale now. There's a link in these episode notes. And it would be really lovely to see you there on the night. And with that out the way, this is episode 181 with Amelia Wrighton, who is the co-founder and CEO of Suicide & Co., a charity that is on a mission to support bereaved individuals and open the conversation around suicide-related grief. And Amelia set up Suicide & Co. with her friend, Emma Morris-Rowe, after they met at work and realised that they shared the same experience of losing someone to suicide. And the charity provides one-on-one professional support through talking therapies and a helpline that is staffed by bereavement counsellors, as well as providing all sorts of resources and initiatives to spark and encourage conversations around bereavement from suicide. And in this episode, I chat to Amelia about her own tragic loss, the impact that it had, and how that led to eventually setting up this incredible charity. We chat about some of the complexities around this very specific type of grief. We chat about using the right words and the importance of knowing how to have these conversations. And it was really lovely to chat to Amelia. Suicide & Co., I've been aware of them for a while. They do amazing things. And it's such a hard topic to navigate. Even from my own perspective, someone who navigates this topic a lot, it's still really difficult and I still always worry about saying the wrong thing and getting it wrong. And so it was wonderful to chat to Amelia about having these conversations as well, about learning the right words. And I think it's really important. I think we could all do with having some of these skills, because chances are at some point in your life you will meet someone who's bereaved by suicide. So yeah, I got a lot from this conversation that I think I will use to be a better podcaster, but also a better friend, you know, and a better person, supporting people when I can. Something we talk about is their conversation guide. This links to that in the episode note. That's a wonderful resource. You'll hear all about that in the chat, but go and have a read, make yourself familiar with it. I think it's really important. So you can get that via their website. The link to that is in the episode notes. All their socials are there. They're really active on social media. I'd highly suggest giving them a follow. They've got their own podcast as well. And yeah, just a huge thanks to Amelia for coming on. If you would like to watch this conversation, you can do so by joining the Patreon community. We're called the Proper Mentalists and it's £3 a month. And after I speak to someone, I put the video straight up on Patreon. And that's where all the videos go. So if you prefer to watch your podcast rather than listen to them, that's where you can get episodes of Proper Mental. You can also submit questions for upcoming guests. And your £3 a month keeps the show going. It keeps it ad-free, sponsor-free, and it just allows me to keep having these conversations. And if some of the things in this episode with Amelia today are of particular interest to you, there are a few episodes that I would like to recommend. Just a couple of weeks back, I put out an episode with the Three Dads Walking, who are currently on another walk, the Walk of Hope for 2024, and they're raising awareness and raising lots of money and having amazing conversations. We actually talk about them a little bit in this episode. I would also recommend an episode with Zanny Byrne, who does the Tandem Against Suicide. Zanny rode around the edge of the UK on a tandem to raise money and raise awareness. And at each leg of the journey, he picked someone up on the bike, someone who had also been bereaved by suicide. And that was a really lovely thing. If you go back a bit further, I did an episode with Angela Samata. That's a really lovely conversation. Angela was part of a BAFTA-nominated documentary about suicide bereavement. And she's been advocating in this space for a long, long time. She's wonderful. She had some wonderful insight. She's got a TED Talk too that's highly worth a watch. Back a bit further again, Gabriel Nathan. He's based over in the States. He's a suicide awareness advocate. He's got a documentary and he had some wonderful insights too. So there's a lot in the back catalogue if you would like to learn more, if you'd like to explore some ideas around suicide. Oh, and Professor Rory O'Connor, who works at Glasgow Uni. He's been researching suicide for around about 25 years. He's got an incredible book called When It's Darkness. Rory came on last year, and that was more about stats and statistics and causation and things like that. That was a wonderful episode. Go and have a look at that too. I think that's enough from me, isn't it? Please take 2 minutes to review this podcast on iTunes or 30 seconds to review it on Spotify. It's a lot easier. Any and all support is very much appreciated. This is episode 181 with Amelia Wrighton from Suicide & Co. Thank you very much for listening. Enjoy. So here we are with another episode of the Proper Mental Podcast, and my guest this week is Amelia Wrighton. How are you, mate?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Yeah, it's a Friday, we're just saying, isn't it? It's a Friday, so the end of the week. So we're both in soft launching the weekend, is it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, mate, while I was waiting to log on, I was just having a little flick through the Suicide & Co. socials. Mm-hmm. And I was really taken with the sector summit that you guys have just done. That looked amazing. What was that all about, mate?
Oh my God, it was amazing. So we decided, Suicide & Co. is now 3.5 years old. We're very proud of the sector that we are in. And we just wanted to basically bring together experts across mental health, trauma, suicide, bereavement, and get them all in one room and learn from each other. So we had over 25 speakers take the stage. That was because we had like 6 keynotes, 4 panels, 3 fireside chats, just for an absolutely packed day of learning. And it was amazing. We had about 150 people in the room, about another 80, I think, in the end online. And yeah, it was amazing. We're going to do it every year. I mean, the feedback has been so brilliant. Like 98% want us to do it again. So we're going to. It was fantastic. It was only 2 weeks ago. And also we decided to do an online Q&A, and we've just made this 18-page document of all the learnings, all of the links to send to everybody that attended, which is like what I would selfishly always want from a conference. So yeah, it's really exciting.
That's it, especially when you're there and you're like taking in so much information, isn't it? You're like, I need to remember that. I need to remember this person. And yeah, handy to have the crib notes afterwards. Yeah. It's I think that in the conversation around any sort of, you know, mental health, bereavement, any of the things we're going to talk about today, collaboration is so important, isn't it? Mm. It's so important to like pick other people's brains and swap ideas. And because I think it's easy to get stale. It's easy to end up in an echo chamber. Is so important, isn't it, to chat to other people on the same mission?
Exactly. I mean, it's also really easy to duplicate, like, and that's the issue, right? In a system where we're all completely stretched, over demanded, underfunded, you know, we need to ensure that we're not duplicating efforts. And you know, when we started Suicide & Co, we did an absolutely intense competitor analysis to go like, what is out there, what's on offer? Like, let's not go and do something, put all this work then, and then be like, oh, they're already offering counseling, right? So, you know, to understand like where this duplication, how we can learn from each other, is so powerful. I mean, I'm very lucky. I have a couple of friend founders, and we're like, do you have a list of this? Do you have a spreadsheet on that? Have you got a policy on this? Because the reality is like that we all do, and we're all spending hours doing things that other organizations have already done or have. And you know, the most important thing we all set up to do is to support the communities that we, you know, are working with. So yeah, it's really, really important that we talk and collaborate, definitely.
Oh, mate, yeah, that variation is key. You know, I bang that drum a lot. You know, I always think of like from my own perspective, and there's so many like amazing organizations out there. And some of them I would 100%, if I knew about them when I wasn't well, I would have used. And there's others I just wouldn't have done it. They just wouldn't have worked for me, right? And the more, you know, we can have... Human beings are complicated, and we can't have a one size fits all approach to supporting people, can we?
No, options is absolutely key. It's what we did, you know, when we started, there was already peer-to-peer support happening in suicide bereavement, but there wasn't counseling on a national scale. There wasn't an app. There wasn't stuff. So everything that we do, we're very much conscious of creating more options because, you know, not only are we all different, you know, and completely different in terms of some like books, podcasts, talking, private, introverted, extroverted. Also, the situations that we're all going through are completely unique. And in our perspective, it's suicide-related grief. And, you know, even within a family unit, we're all experiencing that completely differently because our relationship was different. You know, we're different. So, yeah, absolutely, we have to have variety and options. And, you know, we really strive for personalization within service delivery. Now, that's incredibly difficult when you're delivering, you know, 500 counseling sessions a month, which we are. But, you know, if you lean into things like technology and, you know, your values really representing the lived experience that people are bringing, it is possible. And it's what we all kind of really need to strive towards because it will make it more effective for people that are struggling.
Yeah, definitely. And it is so it's more important than ever, I think, to have charities, to have social enterprise, to have these things going on, because obviously the, you know, through the NHS, it's so, you know, everything's so stretched, you know, and it's there's there has to be other options for people, right? There has to be. And another reason I was really impressed by your sector summit as well is bringing everyone together, because I think when charities are somewhat reliant on funding and donations, you often get a lot of people in the same space chasing the same money. And that can be quite divisive if we're not careful, right? Because it can make a big difference to whether someone, you know, can help other people, but also have a job, right? Next week. So it's really good to kind of put things like that to one side, I think, and remind everyone we're in the same space, we're on the same, you know, we're on the same path sort of thing.
Yeah, you know, it's not a perfect science. It's so difficult to create a safe space where people can come together and collaborate without competitiveness because we are all underfunded. And as soon as you put the government in the room, it's a really hard situation because, you know, they release tiny pots of money, which is all they have, and it doesn't touch the surface. It like literally doesn't even skim what's going on. And yeah, it's really hard. I mean, some of the most collaborative spaces are definitely when grant funders kind of try and bring together their charities that they're funding, because even though it might not be representative of the whole sector or the whole problem or whatever they're doing, once everybody's kind of got that sort of like, we're all funded by this program, or, you know, you can really collaborate and learn from each other. Early in our sort of development, we were a winner of a GSK Grow Award. Like 10 charities win £10,000, and you go through this leadership training together. And we were all so transparent with what we were going through because we were there, we weren't competing, there was no money around, you know, and it really like it changes the game and it allows better conversation. However, I do think because everybody's spoken so much about collaboration and kind of not duplicating now, the more we do talk about it, the more it is happening in other spaces as well, because we're just deciding to put the competitiveness to one side.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, it's just such a lovely thing, right? It's such a lovely thing, everyone coming together and and making changes. Like you say, if we get the government involved, they're not going to do it. So it's kind of like we have to look to ourselves, isn't it, and our local communities, and how can we make change sort of in relation to us. But I feel I'm getting ahead of us here, Amelia. Let's rewind a little bit. What is for people who are listening and don't know, what is suicide and co? How do you explain what you do?
Yes, so we are a charity that operates across the UK, currently delivering in England and Wales, and we support those who have lost loved ones to suicide. So we have a variety of services. Our biggest service is our counselling service. So anybody who has been bereaved by suicide can access 12 sessions of counselling completely free, delivered by qualified counsellors with an assessment up front. We also have a helpline that is open Monday to Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., run by a team of our employees who are called Suicide Bereavement Advisors. They're an amazing team, incredibly empathetic individuals who are experts in the subject matter of suicide loss, both practically and emotionally. We have an app on iPhones only at the moment and loads of resources on our website, signposting to books about suicide loss, podcasts, etc., things like this. Ultimately, we are serving, you know, a big community of those who've been affected by suicide loss, not just parents, children, partners, siblings, but friends, colleagues, managers, community clubs. You know, a suicide loss has a really broad impact, and it can cause our mental health to deteriorate. And that is what we want to prevent, right? Grief is a really hard process to kind of work with, but there are interventions like what I've just mentioned that can help people's mental health deterioration kind of be minimized and not be as kind of impacted as it potentially needs to be. So that's what we do. We're a charity. We're completely run off of people's donations. We've been going since July 2020. And in that time, we've raised 1.2 million. We have delivered 8,000 counseling sessions, had a helpline up and running for 2 years, developed an app, blah, 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 blah. Wow. So yeah. And I'm one of the co-founders and I sit in the CEO role.
Mate, that's, you know, when you mentioned like the counseling sessions there and like, those numbers are wonderful. And the idea that every single one of those sessions, there's a person, right?
Yeah, that's two the thing we've sat together having that. I love like thinking about how many people. Last week was our biggest week and we delivered 120 hours in the week, I think. Is that
good,
right?
Gosh.
And you know, it's amazing to think about the fact that this, I think it was 160 actually. I need to get my stats right. But it's a lot of hours. It's a lot of people connecting and getting that support.
Yeah, very much so. I often try, like with any sort of statistics and figures, I always try and think of it in the realities of the people that are those numbers, you know, and it's just like, it's mind blowing, really. It's mind blowing. Yeah. So can we dig into your story a little bit, Amelia, and how this all came to be and how you got started in the charity sector?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I think, so first it would be like my personal story. So the reason I do what I do really is because my mum died by suicide when I was 19. So, you know, I am an only child. My parents got divorced when I was 3 and my mum was my primary parent. I lived with her and she'd been struggling with mental health kind of for a long period of time. But because of my age, you know, I wasn't aware of the majority of it. It was kind of masked in physical illness and kind of not spoken about. This was also 13 years ago. So, you know, there's a reality of the stigma was absolutely massive back then. It's still pretty big now. So when she died, it was a complete shock, but it was also that worst case scenario that it's not like it had never been in my head, right? So I had this like fear of like, this is the worst thing that could ever happen. But I was still incredibly shocked when it did. And it really shattered a lot of my kind of worldview. I was in my first year at university. I'd, you know, was having a great time. And then this happened. And I have a very supportive family and friends. But the rhetoric that I kind of walked away, either self-made or from others, was I needed to not let this define me. And I needed to not stay on the rails. I mean, I was a pretty big partier back then anyway. And alcohol and drugs were like the big warning signs of like, don't take this trauma and turn it into something even worse. And so that became my like absolute rhetoric of being like, right, I'll stay and I won't wave the flag. And I built a lot of walls around my emotion, around the deep complex feelings I had until they deteriorated my mental health, because suppressing our complex emotions does that. And I was having, small conversations, but not really about what I was feeling. And so I was then at the hairdresser's and she noticed I had alopecia. I was losing a lot of the back of my hair, which obviously as a woman at the age of 20 at this time was pretty horrific to add to everything. Went to the doctor. They said, you know, try and be less stressed. I thought, okay, I don't think I am. I don't think I'm stressed as in how I view stress. But I did lose my mom to suicide. Is that something? And then I took myself into counseling. I was able to afford private counseling, and had a couple of sessions and it kind of changed everything for me. The ability to speak to somebody in a confidential setting, say the weirdest thoughts I was feeling, say the things about blame, guilt, all of this stuff, unlocked a lot in me. And it set the foundation of kind of my future care. And I then threw myself into my career, worked in media and advertising for 8 years, became very determined to become successful in that. But I wasn't having conversations really about suicide loss until 8 years after my mum had died. And I was working with my now co-founder called Emma, who over a glass of wine asked me pretty outright if I'd lost my mum to suicide, because she noticed me avoiding things that she avoided because she lost her father to suicide. And wow. So, yeah, we shared a conversation over a glass of wine about the fact that we'd had a lack of support, no community, never searched for support ourselves, had no idea what was out there. And so then we did the big analysis that I spoke about to check. I mean, ideally, I was looking for something to be like, oh, they're there. I just didn't know about them. Okay, great. Let's help. Fab. But there just really was so little there, so little options, millions of pounds going into prevention, which is incredible, but nothing for people that are left behind who are creating further risk potentially. And yeah, it just became the motivator. Started it as a side hustle in 2020, kind of juggled it with my day job for a couple of years. And then it just grew so quickly, had to kind of go, okay, let's go into this then. And that's where I'm at.
And here we are. Wow, that's incredible. It's incredible that Emma spotted that in you by recognizing things from herself as well. You know, that just goes to show the power of just relatability and shared conversation and things like that. It's so important,
absolutely,
isn't it?
Yeah. And the conversations we've had since and still have, you know, it are amazing, and it's really powerful. And I think if you've been so sort of like stigmatized and sort of, you know, insular about how you're feeling, it takes a long time to kind of, you know, say some of these things. Like I used to remember like going on dates, like first dates, it was my nightmare. How average is it to go like, oh, and what do your parents do? And then I go, oh, well, you know, my dad runs a kitchen company, blah, blah, blah. Oh, nice. What about mum? Oh, she's not alive anymore. Oh my God, I'm so sorry. How did she die? And immediately you're in a conversation where if I say cancer, you're going to go, oh my God, mate, I'm so sorry. I potentially lost this person or I know this. If I say suicide, it brings a different level of, for most people, it brings a different level of awkwardness that they didn't know how to navigate. Or regardless of if it was going to be that, that is how I felt at the time. I felt like, oh my God, we're trying to be happy and, you know, funny and flirty. And instead I'm going to talk about suicide on a first date because it is so easy for you to get out of me. And now people go, what do you do? And I go, I work for a charity. And they go, which one? I go, Suicide & Co. It's pretty immediate in my conversation. But now I'm on that side. I want it to be, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I want to get to the name in particular because I think it's wonderful. But yeah, one of the questions I had kind of from there really is, did you find that people have been maybe a little bit scared to talk to you about it? Because you find that a lot with people who are bereaved by suicide, right? Because it's a scary word and people don't know what to do. And there's almost people get a little bit paralyzed by it, right? They're so scared of saying something wrong that they say nothing at all. The reality is there's nothing really they could say that's going to make it any worse, right? So it doesn't really matter. But yeah, did you find that people were kind of, you know, scared of you basically?
100%. I mean, I speak to that all the time. Like I do public speaking a lot and I literally say, okay, we're all familiar with the word stigma, but actually how it manifests is fear. It's literally just people scared that they're going to say the wrong thing or that they're going to upset you, so they don't say anything at all. And, you know, I even get people now going, God, somebody's just, you know, lost someone to suicide. I feel like maybe it's a bit too early to send them your details. Why? Why is it too, what about, is it the word suicide? You think they just lost someone to suicide and you're going to send them a text that has the word suicide in it and they're going to be like, huh, how dare you? How dare you offer me support? But this is the thing. We think if you work stigma back, we think that by asking somebody if they're okay, we're assuming they're not okay. And that is wrong, right? Because otherwise, why would you be worried to say it? So 100%, like people were very afraid of what to say. And also a big thing that grievers will do is, you know, if you are building up your own walls, you know, you might shut somebody down if they ask you. Yeah, no, I'm fine. Yeah. So then for that person to then ask you again is it's hard to do. It's awkward, and I'm getting the message that you don't want to talk about it, so I'm going to stop asking, right? One of the biggest tips we give is, and this is so specific to when somebody's going through something bad, to say, how are you, feels so minimizing. It's like, yeah, mate, obviously I'm doing, can I swear?
Yes, of course, yeah.
I was about to swear and I was like, oh, but obviously I'm doing shit. Like, I am having the worst time. But what we, you know, kind of teach and encourage is to contextualize your questions. So to say, how are you today? How did you get on this weekend? How are you feeling this week? Because it's not offensive. It's actually like, well, thanks for asking, better than last week. Or I'm still going to close you down. But the reality is those 100% people were afraid to speak and to ask. And if you're presenting and masking really well, you know, it's so challenging. One of the hardest things within suicide prevention as a whole is, you know, one of the signs that we can spot is changes of behavior, but they're not always negative. And when they're positive changes of behavior, it's really hard to navigate it as a supporter of what to ask and how to kind of get the information, right? Because, you know, they're going out more, they're happy, they're distracted, or they're working loads. And it's like really hard to be like, you seem like you're really great, but I'm just, you know, it's a difficult situation. So yeah, a lot of fear that still exists, a lot of work to do in that area.
Yeah, mate, I absolutely love that, changing the question slightly. You know, how are you today? How are you this week? It's because, of course, it's going to be different day to day, week to week, hour to hour. So that's such a beautiful thing. I've not heard of that before. That's a really, really lovely learning that's come out of this conversation already. Yeah, I'll take that on board, because when people, I suppose when people are, you know, presenting really, really well, it also lets us off the hook, because you're I feel weird about asking this question, but they seem fine. I'll ask it when they seem sad, right? It kind of lets us off. So it's another way of avoiding having these difficult conversations. It's tough, huh?
Yeah, it's definitely tough. I mean, I think we're all, you know, people say we're scared of like saying the wrong thing or upsetting someone. We're also scared that they're saying something that we don't know how to handle, which is the vast majority of things that people are going to say, right? But we don't know how to handle is the gut instinct, right? So people don't realize that in these conversations, when we're talking about supporting each other in mental health, we're literally talking about listening and being the gate to support services, right? So a lot of the mass awareness stuff that comes from suicide prevention charities is like, we all need to talk, ask them twice, great. But then once you've asked them, what happens then? Okay, so the reality is you need to be able to listen to it. And then you need to know it's not your responsibility. You're not a trained psychotherapist. There are services that exist, helplines, resources, articles. That is the bit that we're missing in mental health. Everybody just thinks we need to talk to each other. No, once you realize that if you can ask someone the right question, they can tell you something. You don't need to hold that. You don't need to have the answer. All you need to do is, I am so happy you shared that with me. Do you want me to do some research on eating disorders? Do you want me to do some research on what services are available for counseling, or how long the wait list is in IAPS? Or do you want to do it? But what I think we should do is, if you're feeling like this, let's get some support for that. That's literally what we need to do. But when you do that, there's really nothing to be afraid of, even when somebody's at suicidal crisis, because once you're aware that your boundaries, you know, you don't need to turn into this different superhero role and all of this stuff. Very hard in family dynamics, because often parents think, my child's told me this, I will find the solution. Again, you know, it's same with partners and stuff like that. But it's that part of the narrative that's so missing that we need to do to help minimize the fear, because people will be more encouraged if they realize, oh, actually, that's what I have to do. I can do that. You do it in such other guises of life. Like, you can do that bit.
Yeah, that is so spot on. You know, signposting, that is a drum I will beat till it breaks, you know. And if I always feel like, and again, if, I suppose thinking of myself and my own experiences somewhat as well, but it kind of feels like there's loads of people who know about this stuff and there's loads of people who don't. So how do we cross that line? Because So many people I've spoke to, and they say, I didn't go and get help because I didn't know what was there. I didn't know how to find it.
Yeah.
And it's that simple, isn't it? And
Yeah.
just knowing what's out there and being able to pass that information on is such a powerful thing.
So powerful. I mean, I like we spoke about an echo chamber earlier, right? So I know I'm in a mental health echo chamber. I work in the sector. My LinkedIn, I'm like, does every CEO post about their mental health on Friday? And everybody talk about this, amazing. And then, you know, one of my best friends who has struggled with mental health in the past, she's 100% followed Suicide & Co. for 3.5 years. You'd think she'd be in the algorithm. We were last summer talking about the amazing campaign from Three Dads Walking for Papyrus. And for me, Papyrus and Three Dads have been everywhere. I see them everywhere. So I was like, well, you know, for young people, it's Papyrus. And she goes, who? I go, it's Papyrus. She goes, who are they? And I was so humbled and shocked. I was like, how you in this, do you not know that if you're as a young person, you could call this if you were feeling suicidal? Like this is, it's hard. So yes, awareness is massively low. I think, unfortunately, we're in a very difficult system where knowing what's available when is not something that I could even say I know. I have a very good awareness of it, but, you know, I would still need to do the searching. Fact is, people who are struggling very rarely want to do the searching themselves. Like it takes a huge amount to do that. So that is something that we're improving systemically. Services are working on, of course. As a supporter, which is mainly the role that I always promote when I'm talking on podcasts or public speaking, because it's the easiest catch-all. If you know somebody going through a difficult time in a subject matter that you don't know anything about, could be suicide prevention, depression, personality disorder, eating disorders, relationship breakdown, loss of income, you know, doing the research for them, have a little Google and send them something. Hey, mate, came across this on Instagram, just wanted to send it over to you because I know you're going through this. If we could get better at that, at doing some of the digging, because we're in a place where we can, and signposting isn't saying, hey, I'm judging you because I think you're struggling with this. You know, if everybody did that for somebody that they knew bereaved by suicide, we'd be inundated immediately. But still, I get people asking me, you know, should I? What's the right time? Immediately. And then send it to them again. And then remind them again. Like, ultimately, it takes a lot to reach out to support and to keep saying there's this cool service. Follow them on Instagram. Call the helpline. Do you want me to call the helpline and ask what the process is? Loads of things that we can do, you know?
Yeah, there really is. I actually, excuse me, funny you should mention the Three Dads. I spoke to them a couple of weeks ago. And something I talked about with them was how everybody has a role to play in suicide prevention, you know?
Yeah.
And it's kind of reminded me of that from what you were just saying, because a lot of the time in the mental health space, the onus is on the person who's not well, or the person who's grieving, or and that's the person who's not in a good position to do it. You know, you could have showed me 100 campaigns saying, talk about your mental health. I wouldn't talk about it. Right. You know, if someone had asked me twice, I'd have told them to fuck off. I'd have said, leave me alone. Do you know what I mean? It's that simple.
Yeah.
And so, it's finding those ways, those compassionate ways to plant that little seed, because that would have been more effective with me. Plant that little seed and I can water it and keep an eye on it and I'll come back to it. And then you give me a little nudge and I think, well, I will go and have a look. And that's such a more effective and compassionate way to do it, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah. And I mean, like, you know, this subject is so complex. Like, it's, you know, we often talk about like suicide prevention as like one thing. It's such a huge like issue. We need societal change. We need systemic interventions. We need like education, you know, major things to bring down suicide rates that haven't come down in 20 years. However, you know, in terms of like all the people coming together, you know, I think importantly as well, identifying what we can do, what our roles are, what is available is also really important, because like when I stepped into this space, I had a pretty big existential crisis, like even most fundraisers do, right? If you've lost someone to suicide and you don't know that suicide is the biggest killer in men under 50, it's a pretty horrific stat to find out. And then you figure out you're raising all this money, millions is going in, and suicide rates aren't coming down. Like, it's a really overwhelming sector, and it's hard to go through that education. And I am now speaking much more confidently about people who are grieving and when the appropriate times are. It's, again, different per person, but I know some people run into things that, you know, there's a lot of catharsism and amazing things within that, but there's also a need to protect our you know, inner core and our mental health and not deteriorate. And where I settled at with my kind of like moral belief is for Suicide & Co. is there is a huge measurability and impact in an intervention after a trauma. And suicide loss is a trauma. You've lost someone to suicide and you deserve support for that there. A tailored support, which we can do. It's suicide grief specific. You get some counseling, you call a helpline, you read some articles, because that will stop your mental health deteriorating as much, right? If we can try and get more services like that around domestic abuse, gambling addiction, you know, education, stress, anxiety, all of our kind of ability to whatever we're going through to bring back that mental health deterioration, it's a lot easier and more effective to solve, right? When you get to a point of crisis, the complexity of your own situation is huge. To solve that with a helpline or a reach, in some cases it does, in some cases it can be, but you know, we need to just be more realistic about the fact that, like, we need to do all the things from like stopping people to get to crisis to having very solid interventions for when that does happen.
Yeah, very much so, mate. Yeah, it's like you say, it's so complex, isn't it? And it's so and it's so easy to I find myself doing it all the time. You know, I'll find out something new and I'll go down a rabbit hole and I'll be like, this is amazing. And then I'll kind of think, well, it is amazing for this and it's amazing for that, but maybe not amazing for that. Yeah. And it's so easy, isn't it, to get kind of caught in one thing. But yeah, remembering the complexity. I want to come back to the name, mate. We touched on that very briefly because I'm such a fan of talking about these things, of not sugarcoating it, of saying the words, saying the actual word that people say. Was that important to you when you came up with the name, you and Emma?
Absolutely. I mean, so yeah, we came up with the name for two reasons, and it was completely Emma's idea in this. We both had lots of marketing experience, but using the word was really important. I genuinely think people being afraid of the word suicide contributes massively to the stigma. You know, we've popped up in places for fundraisers and things like that, and people have walked past and been like, you know, would you do that to cancer research? Cancer steals our loved ones before their time. It destroys families. I mean, and yet we can say the word. We can talk about it. We can say how horrific it is, but the cancer part, you know, that word isn't what is making us grimace, awkward. Oh, that's a bit strong, isn't it? You know, the more that that word becomes normalized, the better it is for people with suicidal ideation who are feeling shame and for people who are bereaved and left behind. So absolutely having that front and center was really key. And then our And Co was partly to destigmatize that, to put that very like right up in front, but also for us, the And Co represents a reminder that we always have company, because suicide loss, a key factor is isolation due to stigma and feeling like it's the grief that, you know, people don't get, or the worst, or whatever it is that people put it up into this place that makes it unable to kind of connect with others. You know, we believe, and I absolutely, completely, our moral belief is that everybody has company, be it friends, family, or services. Like, factually, we're all under demand, stuff like that, but nobody is alone at any time. That is an absolute fact in the UK. We have people. We might have people that we don't know how to reach out to yet, but we can learn the skills of how to do that. We might not have friends who are the right people to support us in this moment, but we can find other community groups. We can make new friends. You know, there are it really is there. And I think it's just like we've got this amazing project on at the moment called Always in Company. People can find it on our website. We're asking people to submit photos of what company means to them, because it's vastly different. People have submitted dogs, they have submitted sunsets, fundraisers, community clubs, choirs, their family's legs, the home setting, hugely different things, right? And that is what we're trying to get across, right? So there's, you know, there's loads of positive messaging and representation that we need to get out there that makes people kind of remember that they have that. And it's a very, very key part of what our brand stands for.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I love that, mate. Just like, you know, don't tell people what something is. Ask them what they think it is and work around that. It makes so much sense. Yeah. Interestingly enough, in another life, I used to work in a cancer hospital. And when I first started there, it was an oncology center. And that's what we used to have to say when we answered the phone and things like that. And then they changed it. They had a big campaign and they changed it to cancer center because they were like, it puts people off. We need to make this word, you know, safe and soft and take the fear out of it. And there's a big thing around it. And a lot of the things, a lot of stigma in mental health comes from the fear to say those words. You know, people are scared of it. And I think as well, for like someone grieving, like a big part of grief, and again, it's different for everyone, but I think a big part of grief, people want to talk about their loved ones. You know, that's an important part of grief. And often the way someone dies is, you know, it's the least interesting thing about them. You know, there's so many happy memories, so many experiences. And if we're not, if we're scared to ask and we're scared to say that word, the person who's going through it doesn't get the opportunity to kind of, you know, to have the happy memories and explore that as well. It's important, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, we hear it from our community all the time. People feel like their loved ones were minimized to the mode of death, and they feel like people are less likely to bring them up in conversation and talk about the amazing qualities and amazing attributes to them. And one of the most powerful tips I got given, and I can't remember who gave it to me, but it was like last year, and I've just completely made it my own of just using it all the time, is, you know, a lot of people will say to me, oh gosh, I'm so sorry, I lost my brother to suicide. And my, or, you know, whoever they lost. And my next question now is, oh, I'm so sorry, what was his name? And as soon as I say, what were their name? People go, Jake, or whatever it was. And it just, you see them go, oh, thank you. Because that's my person. That's the person I miss. That's the person I have, you know, the basis of, you know, grief being love, and us feeling sadness and missing. And obviously there are complex issues within that. And, you know, not everybody has lost, you know, somebody that's a loved one. It's, you know, somebody that they've lost who was a figure in their life, and there's more complexities to that. But yeah, it's people want to talk about their loved ones in the vast majority of cases, and often aren't given the spaces to do so.
Yeah, and you can't even find out the tips or the, you know, so much you've told me today, Amelia, is like, right, okay, like, this is so useful, you know, and that's why people just don't know it, right? People don't know it. That's what a beautiful thing to ask someone the name of their loved one. And it's so simple. And you said it, and I was like, of course, but also that's bloody lovely. Like, that's, you know, that's why
but
it's so
I didn't
important.
Do it until a year and a half ago. And I work in the space. Like, as in, I have the biggest compassion and empathy with people. It's like, this is, it's also, you know, grief obviously has gone on for decades, but literature, tips, how we deal with it in the modern world, like, it's still a very developing sector, as is mental health. Like, people think, God, you know, I've always heard people go, haven't we done, you know, enough of mental health now? Aren't we, like, we're, and I'm like, oh my God, we're just at the beginning. Like, imagine if people were saying that about, like, physical health. It's like, when you see a new physical health intervention, it's like, you should now walk 10,000 steps, you should now try this chirotherapy or whatever it is. And we were like, oh, we nailed physical health back in the ancient years. And we were not going to, I mean, it's just bizarre the breadth of what can happen in that space and what can't happen in this space. Like, until we get to the point, I often think the workplace is a really good, like, temperature check. If you are in the workplace and you have a headache, you're probably going to go, oh God, I have a headache. Does anyone have any pills? Yeah, cool. I've got pills here. Great. Have some pills. Or not. People don't all take pills for that. Or actually, it's, I feel like it's turning into a migraine. Like, I'm probably going to go home. Yeah, completely fine. You go home. Like, tell me you're okay. If you were feeling really poorly, if you were feeling like you've got sickness or you've got a tummy bug, you know, you'd be like, please, like, why don't you go to A&E? Why don't you talk about it? Let alone if you'd actually broken a foot or something really obvious, right? Or cut yourself, and somebody said, don't, no plaster for you, just keep bleeding. You know, it's not the same. Like, God, I'm really, you know, I've come into work today, my anxiety is through the roof. Do we say that? I do in my work. I had a day yesterday where I was like, guys, my anxiety is through the roof today. Let's just hold on and we can get through this because that's going to present, right? So until we have these things where in comparison, we can talk about, you know, I'm not saying everybody walks in every day and says, by the way, this is everything in my head. But when we're struggling with things and we're finding bits difficult to navigate, until that happens, you know, we're a long, long way away from being in a space where, you know, we're at maturity or everybody should know these tips, you know?
Yeah, definitely. It's kind of like as well that you're coming into work and saying, oh, my anxiety's through the roof. There might be someone sitting there who is also having problems with anxiety and can't say something. And they've like, oh, they've gone first. Now I can go. But yeah, it's interesting when with things like, you know, the conversation around mental health, I think there's a lot of change being made in real time, which means there's also going to be mistakes as well. So I think a lot of it, when people say like, oh, haven't we done enough? It's like, no, because there is a certain element of like tidying up the stuff that hasn't quite worked as well. You know, social media, you know, something I like to say is sometimes we get so hung up on, you know, Instagram reach, we forget to actually reach people. And it's very easy to just throw stuff out into the ether and say, oh, I'm raising awareness, I'm making change. But in reality, you know, we're seeing each other's posts because we're in the same space, but other people aren't. And there's a lot, like you say, there's a lot to do. But was there anything when you started the charity, was there anything that really surprised you, Amelia, about like things that were available or weren't available or any?
Yes. Instagram. I remember being so, you know, we did a lot of analysis online of grief. Like we did a lot of analysis in suicide prevention. We then did loads of research on grief websites. And it was mainly looking in grief websites where I was like, oh my God, like they were mainly, and this sounds really awful, but it was mainly just like people crying into a cup of tea. I mean, it was so depressing. I was like, I'm already sad. And now I'm on your website and I feel like a loser and I don't want to be here. Like, you know, so we were like, right, let's build a bright, colorful, people come onto our website and they say things to us back, being like, it felt warm. You felt like you were talking to me. It felt like a hug. The biggest compliment I take is when people say, you know, weirdly, I kind of feel like cool to be part of this community. And I'm like, that's not weird. That's amazing. You've gone through something horrific. You know, nobody wants to be in this community. If any of us could not be in it, we'd take the easiest route out of that, 100%. Like, let's bring back our loved ones. We'd all want to do that. But, you know, we're in it now. So does it need to be shit? No. Like, let's try and make ourselves feel as good as we possibly can. So one of the things that really surprised me, having got that like kind of insight of like, oh, it's all crap online and charities are, you know, we're ready to disrupt, then got to Instagram after having started really the charity properly and was like, who's this podcaster over here? Who's this community group? What's that blog about grief? And was like surprised in a bit of like, oh God, have we done the wrong thing? Because actually there's lots here. And then was like, hang on a second, this is epic, because this community on Instagram around grief, around suicide, I specifically talk about grief because I do think there are some unsafe ones around mental health more broadly, but in grief, really cool ways of bringing stories to life, of kind of sharing stuff, making people feel heard, you know, scrolling through your normal grid and seeing a quote that just goes, oh, validated, that's cool, you know. That was a big surprise for me, and I think it's really, really popular, and I think I also did really, really beneficial, and I think it can have a big effect of converting somebody who's unsure that they need support, which is most people, to need going, you know what, I'll give it a go. Because I talk about this a lot at the moment. We're hopefully going to do a campaign in September, but you know, I wish we had more playfulness with what support we needed. Like, imagine it's like a food menu. When you look at a food menu, you're like, oh, I'm not in the mood for that. I had that yesterday. Or you know what? I feel experimental. I'm going to try that. Oh, that was disgusting. I'm never having that again. There's a reality if you get to try things and go, okay, actually, oh, I really like this food. So maybe I'll like that one too. I'll try it, right? We never think about our support system. Do you love reading, but you read only fantasy fiction? Well, if you've been bereaved or you've lost your job, why don't you read a book about it? You know, oh, because it's a self-help book or it's blah, 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 but you like reading. So why don't you just see if you like that. It might be something that, you know, and if you don't like it, you've wasted £8 and you can put the book away. But there's just like a thing, lots of people, especially with counselling, go like, oh God, no, I can't imagine that. Like, I don't need it. I'm sad and stuff, but like, I don't need it. And I'm like, okay, I don't know. Who taught you about who needs counselling and who doesn't? Where have you got that for frame of reference? So, you know, it's just, I don't know where I've ended up on that question, but that's just another point that I think.
Yeah, that's it. It's just, it's a lot of fun to explore, isn't it? It's a lot of fun to, you know, explore the different sides and all the rest of it. Yeah. Mate, I know you've got someone else coming up, so I'm going to ask you one more thing. I'm going to let you go. But I was on your website last night prepping for this and looking at all the different services and the resources that you provide. And they're all wonderful. Something that really stood out that is particularly useful to myself, I think, but to everyone, is the conversation guide. And in that, you mentioned about people learning a new language to talk about something. And that really hit home with me. And it hit home with me how in the guide, you're talking about it from both perspectives, whether that's being bereaved or supporting someone. And I know we've kind of touched on language a little bit already, but yeah, that really stood out to me, learning a new language and how we have to have the knowledge, and we have to go slow, and we have to be compassionate, and we have to get used to these words, right?
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. I mean, the conversation guide is definitely one of the things we're proudest of. We've had it for years now, and people do still use it. Essentially, what we all should strive towards is like confidence in situations. So, you know, feeling confident in a conversation about your suicide loss, if you're the griever, or supporting a friend or a family member, you know, confidence isn't something we just get, right? We need skills. We need the language. We need to understand how to do that. And we often forget that part of it. And, you know, there are ways to learn the information, then to practice. And all I would say is like that information is there. We've made it as easy and accessible as possible, you know, but practice makes perfect, if that's still a phrase people use. I don't know. I feel like we don't use perfect anymore, but like, you know, it just the to remove some of the fear, like we spoke about at the start, learning is a great way to do it. And again, with this playfulness, if you're going on holiday, are you looking at where you're going? Are you doing some research of what sites you should see? What restaurants? Are you getting recommendations? Are you trying to make that the best holiday you could have? Right? Most people would. Some of us in more organized ways than others. I'm going on holiday with my boyfriend next weekend. We've got very different methods of planning. But we're both doing it in our own ways. We're both trying to find out that information so that we have the best experience. We need to treat situations like that in the same way. And that is why information like that needs to be freely available. It's why podcasts like this are amazing. And the work you're doing is incredible, because it's an easier form of content that we can engage with and learn from. Like, if people took one thing from this podcast, that would be awesome. They can just walk through life and remember it for as, you know, long as possible. My brain feels like a sieve, but, you know, ultimately, if we can take that information, it's going to help us build that confidence. And it takes a village. It takes, you know, it's not all on the griever and it's not all on the supporter. It is absolutely working together in this. And the best story I've ever heard about the conversation guide is an amazing girl who's kind of been in our service, and she's done service testimonials for us. And she had lost three friends to suicide, and her sisters and family didn't really know how to support her. And so she just sent them links to the conversation guide over WhatsApp. Just said, this is what I'm going through. This is a service for me, but you can also read it because it'll give you a better context of how to support me. And that was like, she said it completely organically. We didn't ask her about the conversation guide. And I was like, that's exactly why we built it.
Oh, mate, it's a beautiful thing, huh? Beautiful thing, yeah. Mate, I'm going to let you go. It's been a pleasure. You said before, you know, if someone listens and takes one thing from it, well, I took more than one thing from our conversation today. It was, you gave me a lot to chew on there. I really, really appreciate it. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. A big up to that Proper Mental Podcast. The Proper Mental Podcast.